You're listening to the Sketchnote Army Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Rohde, the author of the Sketchnote Handbook and the Sketchnote Workbook, and this is the podcast where I chat with sketchnoters and visual thinkers and try to understand what makes them tick. This episode of the Sketchnote Army Podcast is brought to you by the Sketchnote Idea Book, the sketchbook designed for sketchnoters. Equipped with a no-bleed, no-show-through paper, the Sketchnote Idea Book can take almost any marker or pen you can throw at it. Learn more at sketchnoteideabook.com. And now, on with the show. Hello, friends. I know right now we're in a very challenging time in the world, with the coronavirus pandemic happening, and it can be very distressing. I wanted to mention a few things we've created here that can maybe offer a little respite and a moment of joy amidst all these challenging days we find ourselves in. First, for something to listen to while you're at home or wherever you may be, we built up a collection of over 50 Sketchnote Army podcast interviews over 6 seasons, and you can listen to those anytime you like at sketchnotearmy.com/podcast. Secondly, we have the Sketchnote Army Slack, something we've been emphasizing recently. It's an online chat tool, and it's a place that we've created where you can chat with other visual thinkers about sketchnotes, visual thinking, or whatever's on your mind. We've even got a self-care channel there if you need to talk about some things to help yourself out. You can join the Sketchnote Army Slack for free at sketchnotearmy.com/slack. Please sign up for the Slack channel, and we'll talk to you there. Thanks. Hello, everyone. This is Mike Rohde, and in this episode, I talk with Yuri Malashenko, a visual thinker, a sketchnoter, and an Agile coach, and we talk about the value of applying visualization with Agile teams, his goal to launch an online course on visual thinking, and more. I hope you enjoy it.
Hey, everyone. This is Mike Rohde, and I'm here with my friend Yuri Malashenko. Yuri, welcome to the show.
Hi, Mike.
How are you today?
I'm doing great. It's very exciting to be on the show, and thanks for having me.
You're so welcome. I'm glad to have you on. I've been an admirer of the work that you do, the things you're publishing all over the place on the net, and the work that you're doing where you are. So I was excited to have you say yes and join me on the show. So I want to get started the way I do with all these interviews by asking you, who is Yuri Malashenko, and what do you do, and especially, what has been your journey to come into visual thinking?
Yes. Who is Yuri Malashenko? I am several things at the same time. I have a daytime job. I am an Agile coach working for a bank here in Copenhagen in Denmark. And I am helping teams to do their job better. And we focus together on learning and also implementing the ways of working where we have better products to customers, and they love the products and their needs are satisfied. And it's a kind of a job where you yourself and together with the teams continuously improve the way you work. As my nighttime job, as my hobby, but also a large part of my life, it's visual thinking, where I train, I speak, I blog. I am also leading the local community of visual thinkers here in Copenhagen. It's on a meetup.com, and at the moment we are more than 600 members, and we are meeting on a monthly basis. So that nighttime job, my hobby around visual thinking, as you can assume or guess, it's taking a lot of my time. I'm a family man. I have a wife, and we have 2 kids, and family is a large part of my life as well. And I'm trying to juggle my time between these 3 areas and try to be everywhere so no one is hurt. And yeah, that's kind of me. And as far as my visual thinking journey, I think like with many people who are actively using that in their professional life or as their hobby today, I think it all started back in the days when I was a kid, and I saw pencils for the first time in my life. I guess my parents just wanted to get a calm hour for themselves, and they bought me some pencils, and then I just got lost in there, you know. And I was drawing, and in the school I would be drawing on the sides of the workbooks, and in the university people would take the notes the regular way with just lines of text, and I would draw diagrams, and I would draw something that I would learn later, our mind maps and visualizations, just to understand things better. Then when I started my job, I would use visualizations, again, trying to understand how to do my job better. And then when I started working as a consultant, where I would spend my time with customers and workshops and interviews and something you call collaborative co-creation today, then I realized that all of my doodles and my fooling around with drawings is a big thing, because it really helps doing that type of job better, especially around facilitation and co-creative workshops. And then in 2015, I eventually realized I could also do trainings on the topic to help other people get up to speed. So that's my journey up to right now, when I'm already 5 years into taking visual thinking quite professionally, being a trainer, blogger, and just an active member of the community of visual thinkers. Yeah.
Wow, that's a really great story, and it's interesting that it began with a pencil. I have a question that just occurred to me when you were speaking. So I know you're from Ukraine.
Right.
What was the environment like there? Because if you somehow managed to keep drawing as part of your life, all the way from being a kid till now, and maybe there were moments along that journey where it was more challenging than others, do you think it was pretty well accepted that you did drawing? Did you have to fight pretty hard for it, or what did the culture in your Ukraine in some way maybe make it more possible for you to continue to be a visual thinker all the way from when you were a kid till now?
Well, it's a funny thing, actually, because while Ukraine was still a part of the USSR when I was born, and actually my first two grades in school, it was still a part of USSR. It's a totalitarian regime and freedoms oppressing and that kind of stuff. But interesting enough, if you can draw and you draw really well, then you're a popular person among authorities, with authorities. Because, for example, when I was in the school, once my teacher singled me out as a guy who could draw. Suddenly, I would draw all of those big holidays, propaganda posters, and that kind of stuff. So you can actually get by quite well with that kind of hobby, which is pretty much in need and in demand. And then my parents were joking that, okay, and of course they just tried to extrapolate the lifestyle, and they would tell me that if you had to join the army, and everyone in USSR had to be conscripted to serve 2 years in army, then you would probably get some easy job back in the headquarters drawing propaganda posters. So So that, from that angle, it's not something that is a bad thing to have, I guess.
Interesting. I wouldn't have guessed that. I mean, I just sort of wondered. I feel fortunate that somehow I managed to hold on to my drawing skills all the way from being a kid until my adulthood. And there were some times where maybe it was not as strong as other times, but it still was a part of me. And it seems to me like that's a similar thing that was happening with you. And I just wondered about the environment. It sounds like maybe that it was encouraging. Were there ever any challenges where you sort of questioned, like, or where you had to hide your visualizations just for yourself and not show that to an authority or a teacher or something like that?
No, I never had such an experience. I guess I was more encouraged than threatened with that. As long as you keep your drawings away from the books and you comply with the format of submitting your work and you keep it clean and separated, then you're not in trouble. So no oppression.
That's really good. That's good to hear. I think I just wonder. That brings me to the present, and now there's lots of educators who are very fascinated by visualization, sketchnoting, this whole space. And I wonder what that looks like for the next generation, for your kids and my kids, if when they come to school, there's that same kind of encouragement and actually preparation for being able to visualize concepts in the way that we naturally did as kids, and we somehow survived through the process, that what happens when there's a whole generation of kids who are actually encouraged in that way? What would that look like? I can't even imagine it, but it seems like a pretty cool thing.
It's difficult to imagine what the future holds for our kids. My oldest is 13 years old now, and he is attending a regular Danish school, something called Folkeskole, which is like a people school. Mm-hmm. And I can see that there is a lot of digital in how they are being taught and the material provided. And they don't take notes that much. But at the same time, I know that my son, he just by observing what I'm doing with my notes and my way of taking notes, and I have had the whiteboard back in our apartment for the past, I don't know, maybe 7 years or so. So he would also try to mimic what I was doing. And I can see that he's thinking with a pen. And whenever he's doing some assignments, I can see that he's doing some kind of an ad hoc diagramming, thinking out externally on paper. So I don't know whether it's something that also is encouraged in the school, or is that because he is trying to mimic some of the practices I'm using myself. But I personally think that there should be more of that. I don't deny the digital aspect of it. It makes things easier, but also smoother for teachers as well, because then there is less manual handover for them to check stuff, and mm-hmm. a lot of stuff can be automated, of course. But I think it has to be somehow balanced out, so there is a lateral creative thinking fostered with kids, but also their native ability to work with technology all molded together in some kind of seamless experience for them. Mm-hmm. But I think that would be good, because then they could choose the method which is more applicable to the situation, and while staying native, working with technology and being organically literate in using technology, but then escaping into the world of handwritten or hand-drawing situations to help them out if they're stuck. I don't know. I think it should be a combination of.
Yeah, I feel the same way, and I think it's going to be interesting to watch the development of the next generation, especially when you have a thing like an iPad Pro and Pencil, which sort of straddles the line between it is technology, but it also supports sort of a drawing with the hand and thinking with the hand, which I'm sure we'll get into in a little bit. That's pretty interesting, and I guess we just can't know, but it's exciting to think that maybe there will be more tools available for our kids to help them solve the problems that we can't even imagine too, right? So that's, maybe they're going to need these tools to be able to solve the problems that are going to face them that we can't imagine, right?
Absolutely.
I want to shift a little bit to, you talked about your day job, and I'm very curious to hear, as an Agile coach, how these visualization techniques, the variety of them, apply to your everyday work at work with your colleagues. Because I think maybe not everyone sees that. We see what you're doing on Instagram, and some of that stuff is coming through. Like, I've seen some of your work reflecting that. But maybe it would be interesting for people who maybe can't see everything that you're talking about with your coworkers to have sort of a general idea of what you're doing in an office setting with visualization, sketchnoting, mind mapping, whiteboarding, all that kind of stuff. How does that look for you?
Yeah, I use that a lot. And that is one of my core skills that allows me to do my job effectively as an Agile coach. And even though I know a lot of Agile coaches that not necessarily employ the methods of visual thinking while still being pretty successful in their job, but for me personally, that's just an integral part of my job delivery. And if I just take through a kind of a couple regular days from an Agile coach life, from my perspective, just to go through all of the different things I'm using from the visual thinking toolkit to give you an idea, how it's integrated in my working life. So it's a lot of personal notes, visual notes, which I'm taking all the time, either digitally or the analog way. And the note taking has become a part of me. I'm doing that all the time. So let's say if my day starts with a meeting with a team and I'm not taking an active part in that, or even if I'm taking an active part as well, I'm taking notes. And then I have my physical notebook with me. I carry all the time. So I just incrementally grow the notes in there. But recently I have started working with digital note-taking as well. So sometimes if I feel like taking notes there on my iPad Pro, I'm doing that, or sticking more to my traditional notepad. And sometimes if I forgot my iPad or let's say it ran out of battery and I forgot my notebook at my desk, but I was dragged into a meeting, then I would still be taking notes, but then you always find some sticky notes in the meeting room and some loose felt tip pen I could use for that. And then what I usually do is I just, you know, I don't stack them one on each other, but I start with one, then I place it on the table, then I continue with the second, place it next to the first one, and then I just grow my canvas or on the wall, whatever. I feel very, you could say, relaxed doing these things. And then I take a snapshot and then I have it digitally. So I'm taking notes all the time. And that's a big part of my work. Then let's say I'm facilitating a workshop, or we are having an ad hoc meeting with a team or with other people I'm working with, and we're discussing something, and quite often it's challenging and complex and we cannot get away with just words. So then I would use a whiteboard in the meeting room, or an A4 paper, or maybe A3 paper, anything basically that allows me to externalize the conversation, where I would be mapping our conversation using whatever fits, just to visualize what is that we're talking about. If it's planning, there will be a lot of timelines. If it's structural things, for example, oh, we are not sure these teams are set up the proper way, then we would draw teams and their relationship. There is a lot of drawing in that as well. And suddenly I exited the realm of something I control, because my note-taking is a personal, individual activity, but now I'm entering the realm of other people. You could say I am penetrating into their comfort zones, but people who know me, they know that that's just the way I operate, and they also learned to find value in that. So they're fine with me doing these things. As long as they can see it's bringing value to them. So we're not just fooling around. And then on some days I engage in trainings, and then when I train, I usually draw the explanations on flip charts, and sometimes I draw explanations on A4 and use a document camera to project my drawing on a large screen. Sometimes I draw that on an iPad connected to a large screen or a projector. And then whenever I explain stuff to the students of the course, it's always a session of a live drawing, because that's the best engagement and the best impact on the audience when you do it like that. I never use slides or even the pre-drawn posters. It's because it's, for me, it's like a dead knowledge. It's a knowledge from someone else. But the knowledge that is created before their eyes, that's the magical moment for the audiences. And I know how to do that, so it's not a stress for me. I concentrate on the material, and I'm not struggling with how should I draw that. And then finally, another large example, not large example, but example of a large portion of what I do. There are a lot of one-on-one conversations with people, either about some struggles they are facing in doing their job, or maybe they are facing some challenges, or maybe they want to develop something. There is a lot of conversation, and again, a lot of the things we're discussing are abstract, are not something you can really touch. And then again, I would use an A4 or letter size if it's the US mm-hmm. standard, that kind of size, or my notebook, or again sticky notes, or an iPad, and we draw the situation out with the person. So often you can see me sitting side by side with the person I'm working on. I'm engaged in a coaching session with that person in a safe environment where, for example, we are locked away from the rest of people in a room so that they feel comfortable discussing sensitive things. And we would just draw things out. And similar to how I do that with the teams, we're still mapping, we're drawing pictures of their situation. But now in a one-on-one situation where we have trust and we are working together to solve the problem. These are the most, you could say, the most common examples of me using the technique. And you can, and I hope you can see how it's tightly integrated into the job. It's not like you can isolate, oh, now I'm an agile coach and now I want to spend some time working with visuals, because I haven't had fun in a while. It's basically a large part of my job.
Interesting. It's in some ways, that's the most healthy way, right? It just becomes an extension and it's so integrated that it can't be separated from you. It's just part of the way you operate. And I think people appreciate that, especially I can imagine those one-on-one sessions where they walk away, they see what they're thinking visualized is externalized from them. And then maybe they can let go of it in a way they couldn't before, where it was stuck inside their head and it kept bouncing around. Sometimes simply stating those things that you're thinking is either a good way to say, well, that's crazy, why am I thinking that? That's silly. Or, ooh, that's a really good idea, I had never thought of it that way. I think those are two common, seem to be common reactions when you see your thinking, you know, visualized. How do your colleagues react to those one-on-one sessions when you do them with them?
Just as you said, there is a lot of, if not revelation, but impactful insights where they say, oh, that really helped me to sort things out, or literally see the situation, or see it from an angle that helps me overcome my biases or become untangled from my personal ego-driven perspective, or helps me to understand how my interests are tied to the situation, because I suddenly can see the unseen relationship of me to the situation,
right.
Becoming more aware of my motivations and driving factors of my behavior. Basically, all of that can be summarized as suddenly people see what they probably have as a mental image, but it's so complicated inside of their heads that, the brain really struggles to come up with a clear vision of what that is. They have all of the understanding is there. All, what is happening, we just help ourselves see that clearly so that we could send that mental image back into the brain to sort things out.
Mm-hmm. It's almost as if you were in a, let's say you were in the middle of New York City. Well, you could see the buildings right in front of you, but because you're at the same street level, there's a limit to what you can see. But when you get into an airplane and you fly over New York City, now you can see the relationships, let's say, between downtown and Brooklyn and Harlem and the water and, you know, Connecticut. Like, you can start seeing those connections because you're able to rise up in some senses with an overview of the problem. I imagine this is maybe a similar experience, that they're able to step a little bit above the problem in that sense.
Yes, I like that metaphor where you use the field of view constrained by your physical position to the objects you're trying to see. And sometimes I use a different metaphor to explain this phenomenon, where I try to compare ourselves with how CPUs, the central processing units, work. They need an operational memory to do the calculations, right? And I don't know. Probably it's a wrong model, but it helps me explain this phenomenon in a way that when you put stuff on paper, what you do is that you dump a lot of complicated information from your hard drives in your head, but your capacity to process with your head without any visual aids or some additional aids is really limited to a very shallow operational memory, and you just get stuck. You're like moving in a swamp knee deep. You know, you cannot move faster because that's your like operational memory limitation. But when you put stuff on paper, suddenly you get an extra RAM on that paper or iPad or wherever it is. And then suddenly you move faster because then you can process more information. You don't have to keep it in your brain operational memory. And then that's how I see it. So you could say either a kind of a being lost in the New York City or being constrained with your naturally limited operational memory of brain, whatever helps you see it. But yes, it's that kind of experience.
Well, I think your colleagues are quite lucky to have you on the team, that you are there to guide them in all these different modes of visual thinking, and it's so integrated. I can imagine that maybe if they moved to another company where this is not the case, that they would miss it, and they would wish that it still exists in this new company that they that they join, which I guess is a big credit to you in the way you're helping them, you know, using all your capabilities to help them understand the work they're doing and seeing it in a different way.
Hopefully so. I hope they see it the same way. And if that's the case, what I'm trying to do to mitigate that effect of things, especially the effectiveness of collaboration and working together, hinging on one person who is extremely skillful in that type of expertise, I'm doing a lot of community building, not only outside of the bank I'm employed with, but also inside of the bank. So I started the community at approximately at the same time as I did for Copenhagen, but at the same time I started the similar one inside of the bank, and it's a smaller version of the Copenhagen community, where we also meet on a monthly basis, and I'm just trying to convince people that it's not something that they need to invite someone specifically skilled to help them out, but they can learn to do that, and step by step, small things, one small thing at a time, they could enrich their toolkit and start doing the same things. And I see my additional mission is to get somewhere where people in the entire organization can do that, not really relying on someone like me. Even if we had 10 times more people as who would do the same thing, it's still not enough. I think it's just something that everyone should be doing. Of course, some people will be more skilled, some people will be less skilled, that's fine, but at least some really low level, something you could call hygienic things, people should be able to do alone.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
So that it's not a disaster if I, for example, move to another company or move to another assignment and suddenly that lack of expertise. Because, you know, it's like with good services, right? If you get used to them and then when they're gone, then you feel this vacuum, nothing can fill. And I don't want that because I don't like the idea that I'm a bottleneck. At least that's not in the spirit of agile coaching. You don't want to become something which is irreplaceable. You want to encourage people to develop to an extent that they don't need you. So I want to extrapolate that idea to visual thinking. I want to help them now, but then give them the encouragement that they could do that themselves. So when I'm gone at some point, hopefully, they can do it without the external help.
Yeah, it's much more powerful, I think, if each individual internalizes and finds ways to use it, and then it's a lot more powerful. It's the same impact of the community and having this visual thinking, sketchnoting community of people. It makes us stronger because so many people can do it and they're sharing in places where you and I can't go to, or it's difficult for us to go to, but they're there to share those concepts and move it forward, and each individual location can keep growing. That's, I think, a much more sustainable, you know, approach to doing, to sharing the concepts for sure.
Totally agree. Yes.
So I'm going to shift a little bit now from your work life, which sounds pretty interesting, to the things you're doing on the side in your second job, I guess you would call it. And this is specifically the things that I see in social media. And for me, that is the two places I see it the most are Instagram is one and LinkedIn as well. And that's an interesting set of choices that you're making to do Instagram, maybe more for the visual thinking community in some senses, or average people, I suppose. And I mean, there's some degree of that on LinkedIn, but LinkedIn specifically seems to be focused on the business space, where, you know, you're approaching a slightly different group of people with similar teaching and concepts and articles and so forth. So talk a little bit about your philosophy around why you chose those two. And maybe there's other ones that I've just not discovered yet where you're sharing your work in your side job.
That's a tough question, because I don't think there is a clean scientific explanation to these choices. I think it was more following the natural flow of things, like a water. It flows where it can flow. And with these choices in particular, at some point I have noticed that the response and reaction on LinkedIn posts was higher than in other places. And of course, you bet where it grows better. So I kept LinkedIn going, and that led to the growth of the network, and it also led to some good effects of so-called word of mouth spread. It helped me get some extra gigs here in Denmark, and surprisingly, it worked much better than the direct marketing through Facebook or even through LinkedIn itself. And it helped me understand that the organic growth on LinkedIn was much more powerful than, let's say, buying the marketing campaign from Facebook. And then I just kept growing it, because it works really well. And Denmark in particular, I think, is one of the examples of closed communities, and people are not really open to marketing, like a direct marketing from people they don't know, especially when it comes to some exotic topics like visual thinking. Visual thinking is still an exotic topic because it does not necessarily tell you how much do you become better if you invest into that. It doesn't have the worldwide accepted certifications that take your salary like 10-20% up if you take the course, right?
Right.
So it's something still on the exotic side. And when it comes to these things, you only trust your friends or your colleagues, good colleagues, that tell you like, this is cool stuff. I took it and I have enjoyed it so much, and it makes my life so much easier, or I now know how to do my presentations. So that kind of marketing is much more powerful. And as of today, LinkedIn is my best platform for finding my next external assignment for my hobby job. Now, when it comes to Instagram, I used to find a lot of inspiration on Instagram myself. And I have noticed that some people were very successful there, growing their audiences, especially operating in the field of visual thinking. And I also heard a lot of rumor about Instagram becoming like the new e-commerce space, basically. And I was just lured by those rumors and decided to also bet on growing the audience there. And I didn't take it very aggressively. It was like focusing on good content and making sure that, well, actually, I just follow a very simple rule. I share stuff that I wish I had found myself like a few years back. So that's my basic rule. So don't just put something that is just like a clickbait or looks shiny, but it didn't cost you much. I just put stuff that I think is worthwhile, at least from the perspective of my criteria. And I don't have any particular strategy there. Well, so far it's slowly growing and I'm happy with that. And I get a lot of nice feedback and good cheering up from the audience. And that's good enough for me.
Yeah, but that's always good. Yeah, to have encouragement, and it's I think a two-way street when people see the work and they get inspired. I know lately on Instagram I've noticed you're playing around with Procreate, where you're laying out, maybe it's a concept you're using at work, like a process map or what have you, and you're recording yourself doing it in Procreate and then playing it back as a little movie on Instagram. So I see it like unfolding in 30 seconds or whatever the time window is. And I found those really fascinating, really enjoyed that. And I think it provides someone who maybe heard the term or has, maybe they don't use that technique in their daily work or in their daily life, to see it, then they can imagine, oh, that's really interesting. Maybe I could try that with this project I'm working on or the garden that I'm redesigning or what have you, right? To use these concepts in a way that they hadn't, may have not thought about it before they saw that little 30-second snippet from you.
Yeah, it's something that I have experimented with over the past several days. And the idea was coming from my analysis of different types of posts that you can do on Instagram. And I was tinkering with this idea for some time. I have the tendency of putting too much content in a post. And I just like to put a lot of stuff. It's both good and bad, because it's good because it's good to have some solid content to share, but it's bad because people don't have time to absorb it. And sometimes too much is as repelling as nothing at all. And on Instagram, if you want to share a lot of stuff, what you could do is that you could post a few photographs packed into one post. And To my surprise, I was observing this effect that when you do a lot of stuff, when you package a lot of stuff in one post, even though it's cool stuff and you know it, people don't notice because they don't, for example, swipe through that stuff.
Yeah.
And a lot of good things get buried and not noticed, and then you're discouraged because you put a lot of effort into that, but people don't notice that, and it's like a bad feeling. So I was thinking, like, okay, I still want to share a lot of stuff, right? But I know that people will not reveal that. If I put that in a video format, will it solve the problem? Because I can kind of hide a lot of cognitive layers in a video, because I could show a few scenes. I could layer a lot of content in one go. And so far, I see that it's a good workaround. So you don't have to package a few photos in one go. And a lot of people really carefully watch those videos. And one of the metrics I'm using is that the ratio between how many people liked it and how many people bookmarked it. So far, it's almost like 2-to-1. And that's the highest ratio I have ever seen with my historical posts. So I'm just thinking maybe that's a good way to do that.
Yeah, I've noticed that same dynamic happening. Let's say I traveled to a new city like Paris last year. If I do one post with lots of photos of Paris, there's a good likelihood someone might see the first one, but they may not swipe to see the others. But if I post them individually as individual posts, one after the other, it seems to get more engagement, and then people enter into the one that's most interesting to them. So that's interesting to take it one level. You're sort of taking that swiping and you're doing the swiping for them by building it in to a single frame. So they never have to change the frame. They just see the action, which I guess additionally is probably attractive, right, in its own right, to see something moving. You want kind of want to tend to see where things are going to end. So that's additionally attractive. So that's a really good move on your part. And it caught my eye. And I thought to myself, I wonder how could I use something like that? Maybe that's the thing that will get me playing around a little more with Procreate, is trying to do some little demo videos or playing with that in a different way. So thanks for sharing that. And hopefully it'll be encouraging for other sketchnoters and visual thinkers to start playing with that concept, to share
absolutely,
you know, things that are unfolding over time, which I think you don't want to commit to like a whole YouTube video for 20 minutes, but maybe just 30 seconds. And I assume you can speed it up in some way, either with Procreate or whatever the mastering tool is for the video, so you can fit it in that short time frame. And then that provides, you know, a quick glimpse, so you don't commit too much time and yet you still get lots of value from it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad to share that. And if my insights or findings help someone to provide a better quality content to the community, then I'm all for it. But also, one comment to that thingy where you break down the packaged posts into individual ones. That's exactly the way to go about it. And indeed, each individual post would be even more impactful as compared to the package as a whole. The problem is that if you have some narrative that is critical to be consumed in a certain sequence, mm-hmm. then it's not going to work, because a lot of times people don't necessarily consume all of your posts, and right. usually they just accidentally stumble upon one of them. So if it's one of a series, even if you put a lot of instructions in the comments, like, okay, this is like part two, please watch part three.
Right.
It's not read. So your narrative will get broken. And yeah, the only way to get a narrative across is to make sure it's in one frame. Otherwise, it's just not going to work.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yep, I think you're right. I think someone could drop into the middle of a series and not know to go back or forth. Or maybe they start with that one and go forward, but they haven't looked at the previous ones that set up the middle part and everything after. So it's definitely got some problems, depending on what your goals are. So that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
I have a question related to, I guess, if we talked about your day job and your night job. what do you think, how are you thinking about the future? What's getting you excited about, it can be either work or personal, into the future? What are the things that you're most excited about?
Well, a few things keep me excited. Professionally, I mean, daytime job-wise, I am developing myself into the career of a product manager. It's in the same field, but you could say keeping their hands dirtier, because you are a part of a product delivery,
right?
And you have to have more delivery related accountability, and that is something that I want to have. So every time I am working with teams, I try to stay closer to those parts of the organizations where I could be more valuable and contribute more to people doing product management, either by sparring with them or helping them out or coaching them, because sometimes my experience is bigger than certain product managers whose teams I'm helping out. So I'm just trying to keep busy with work resembling such of a product manager. But of course, it's not the same as being a product manager in the first place. So that keeps me excited, because I really want to shift to that type of job in future, and I'm working on that. Also, on the side of my nighttime job, my hobby job, I have a few ambitious plans for the year. One is that I want to consolidate my training experience and expertise and package that in the online course, which I'm probably going to publish on Udemy,
mm-hmm.
so that I can spend less time delivering real trainings and send people to my virtual course instead, and mm-hmm. also using the basically economy of scale, because now you can run a lot of courses simultaneously without the need of being there.
Right.
And another thing is that I want to also package my personal experience working with Visual Thinking Toolkit in a format of a book, and I know that's a large undertaking, but I have examined the topic, and I think I'm going to self-publish it, and I have an idea of a series of cases. So it's not like a book you need to read from a cover to cover, but more like a cooking book where you say, okay, I'm going into a brainstorm meeting, right? So you hit the TOC, the table of contents, and then you see, okay, brainstorming. Where is that? Okay, here. And then you open, let's say, a chapter, which is the equivalent of the online 7-minute reading. And that's probably how much time you have to prepare, right? And then you read it and you have some actionable things you can enact and just take it into your meeting and hopefully make it better as compared before reading that chapter.
Mm.
So I understand that people cannot just spend hours reading the book,
right?
But they need something really practical, and I examined a lot of visual thinking books, and I think there is a niche for cooking book kind of books.
Sounds really cool. I think both those things, both training, online training, video training, and a book sound like great next steps for you in your hobby job, and to codify and have things that are available to people in a more substantial format that they can refer to. I really like that. So I'm going to shift direction a little bit again. We're going to shift to tools now. I'm always very curious about each guest and what their favorite tools are. And I like to do them analog tools first. So any pencils, pens, paper, those things that you like to use regularly. And then switching over to digital, the kind of, whatever software you might be using or other little tidbits that you have found that help you with your digital visualization would be great.
All right. I'll start with the analog tools. I'm a big fan of the notebooks with just plain white paper.
Mm-hmm.
My tool of choice would be the Moleskin ones, but I'm not religious about that.
Mm-hmm.
Any substitute brand would do, as long as it's a similar experience with the quality of paper and it doesn't collapse when you fold it and fold multiple times. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a Moleskine as such, but it just has to be a similar experience when it doesn't fail you, mm-hmm. and the paper is nice and the rest of the experience is nice. As far as writing or drawing tools, I think 3 years ago I became an ambassador of Neuland in Denmark.
Yeah. Yeah.
And therefore I have access to all of the tools and some really good offerings from the brand, and their markers are very, very decent. So when it comes to sketchnoting, I'm using their technical pens and brush pens, and basically that is the core of my toolkit.
Mm-hmm.
I always have a technical pen. I prefer the 0.3 to 0.5 depending on my mood size for texts and drawings in my sketchbooks. And I always carry a few brush pens, but at least of two colors, the light gray and the vibrant yellow, which is called brilliant yellow in Neuland's universe. And those are like must-have tools because they allow me to do my note-taking at the best level of quality. And the technical pen is instrumental because They are waterproof, and if you apply shading or highlighting, they would never smudge.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to larger size, I kind of quit on Neuland a bit, because recently I have identified those markers by Pilot. I think they are called sign pen.
The big
sign
ones,
pen.
Right? Yeah.
No, they're kind of Sharpie size. Size-wise.
Okay. I'm thinking of something else then.
But the tip size is similar to Sharpies.
Mm.
But the good thing about these Pilot pens is that their tip size, even if it's wearing down over time, it stays consistent. It doesn't really change the size of the line. And Sharpie is not really good about it, because Sharpie mm-hmm. becomes, they should be called Sharpie a few days, and then they are blunties.
And then they're mushy. Yeah.
And then they're blunties, right? Because they lose that sharpness really quickly.
Yeah.
I'm heavy-handed. I put a lot of pressure, and I cannot do anything about it. It's just the way I am. And I destroy a lot of pens because of that, especially the technical pens. They just, they burn like matches in my hands. and then Sharpies are not really good at that. But I also have a few Sharpies with me all the time, because they dry out phenomenally quick and they're really good on sticky notes.
Mm-hmm.
But the design pen has a huge flaw. It's not waterproof, and you cannot really apply the shading and highlighting without really smudging stuff a bit. It's a spectrum of tools with downsides and strong sides. And I'm so nerdy. I know all of those, and I choose the tool, you know, do the job kind of stuff. And then I always have the Pilot pens for whiteboard with me.
Okay.
They're a bit better as far as the opaque quality of the ink compared to Neuland's, and they are easier to refill, because they need just the cartridge to be replaced, while you really need to undergo a certain procedure. Even though Neuland made it super smooth with the small syringes, you can squirt some ink into a marker when it's dead. But it's better to use the cartridges, because the replacement is just so much faster. And again, for me, it's quite important that the black is like super black and the other colors are having a good coverage of the ink. Mm-hmm. So I prefer them more. And I do a lot of whiteboard stuff, so it's important for me to have reliable pens with me. And yeah, so basically a few whiteboard markers, a few medium size for sticky notes or for A4 or A3 paper situations. And then the sketchnoting tools and the reliable notebook. So that concludes the analog part. When it comes to the digital world, I'm using the iPad Pro, the larger one. And I have two applications that I admired the most, at least at the time. And I'm constantly experimenting and trying new stuff. So those two applications are Procreate, and another one is called Concepts.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I love both of them, and they have ups and downs, both of them. So depending on the situation, I am switching one of them. So as far as Procreate, I use that especially when it comes to those time-lapsed videos, mm-hmm. especially the ones I've been creating recently for Instagram. I just simply love that feature. And as far as note-taking, well, maybe you'll be surprised, but I prefer Concepts more. It has this fantastic feature that allows you to automatically switch between the layers depending on which type of the marker chose.
Mm-hmm.
So it means that, for example, I prefer to always put a bit of shadow and highlighting on my notes when I take them digitally. So I have basically three brushes preset in Concepts, one for the technical pen and two for the shading and the highlighting. So every time you choose the other two markers, virtual markers, of course, the layers are automatically swapped.
That's
and
nice.
I don't need to remember to do that.
Yeah,
and
that's really
I'm
nice.
So bad at that. Yeah, you know how it's painful to mess up the layers, right?
Yeah.
So Concepts was smart enough to introduce that feature, and now I just cannot live without it.
And the thing I like about Concepts for me personally is occasionally I do illustration work, and if I do it on the iPad, I like to use that tool because I can export the file as an Adobe Illustrator compatible file and then do further modifications for art production in Adobe Illustrator. It's a pretty natural move. I've done that in a few projects, so that's convenient to have everything vectorized to do that, in addition to, well, you can create your own libraries inside Concepts, so you can draw all your elements and be able to draw them, drag them back into your own drawings if you wish to do that. So that's another nice advantage to that tool.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have a question to you based on that. Have you faced any issues with exporting of the line styles from Concepts to Illustrator? I didn't really like the experience of I don't know why was that, but it looked like some of the stuff got scaled up or scaled down a bit when exported to Illustrator, and it messed up a bit of the line width. I expected it, for example, being thicker, while it turned out to be a bit slimmer in the Illustrator, and just kill the vibe a bit in the illustration.
Yeah.
Did you notice anything like that? Or?
I've noticed similar issues. The other issue with Concepts is the way they look at erasing is almost not really erasing. So if you erase over something, it simply lays white ink over that. So when you export it out, now you've got to sort of untangle the pieces. So usually when I do this work, I must take those things into account when I'm exporting. So I try not to do erasing. And I understand that I might have to fiddle around in Illustrator. I think of it as a step along the process. So I sort of plan for some modifications inside Illustrator to get it to final state. I think in the case of the project I had, it was an interesting project where I had a map to do, a visual map, and I did it as ink. And when the client saw it, they said, oh, we really wanted that in pencil. And now normally you would be in a real trouble, right? You'd be redrawing everything.
Oh, yeah.
But with Concepts, the interesting thing was I selected piece by piece and switched it. I changed the stroke to pencil, to a 2B pencil. So it took a little time, but basically select a chunk, convert, and then you kind of keep an eye on how it's looking and tweak it. But I think within an hour, I took a completely ink-drawn visual and turned it to a pencil-drawn visual with some tweaking, and then was able to export that out and use it as final artwork. So there are definitely some advantages if you know how to, you know, to plan for it, I guess.
And that wouldn't be possible in Procreate because it renders the brushes the moment you put it to the digital paper, and that,
right.
And then all the pixels are there and you cannot do nothing about it. And then with the Concepts, the application deals with the vector format. You can actually change the style of brushes indefinitely, basically.
Yeah, definitely. I have a running theory that I think most of the drawing applications actually are using vectors in the background, because if you think about it, using mathematical locations and curving and stuff is probably very efficient for the software to be fast. But I think Concepts is the only one who reveals those vectors to you, allows you to edit them and export them and use them in a different way. I think maybe those other vendors are keeping those behind the scenes, probably for the problems that you see that Concepts is challenged with. You know, line weights aren't maybe what you expect, and maybe the erasing wouldn't look so great, or there might be other things that we can't imagine. But I kind of wonder about that sometimes, if there's actually vectorization going on in the background and we just simply see it as represented as ink on the screen. It would be hard to know until I talk to a developer, but that's some of the challenges with Concepts. But I think, you know, like any tool, once you know what the limitations are, you can, for the most part, either know whether that tool will work or not, first of all, And then second of all, if you choose to use it, you have to go into it knowing your workaround and your solution to deal with that challenge. So that's
absolutely
it's just a good way to look at any tool, is to find its strength and weakness, and you try and choose the best one and plan for the rest, and you should be okay.
Yeah. And I'm sitting now and smiling because the things you just said about the things probably being really a vector in the background and behind the scenes, but that is not revealed to you as a user. I was almost about to start nerding out in that topic, but then I realized that probably you have other plans for the further direction of the conversation. So I really fight myself back a bit. Like,
yeah.
No.
Don't yeah, go we could there. Have a separate podcast about technical details. Maybe that would be an interesting... this is just an aside, but to have developers on and ask them those questions, that's an idea for me to file away.
And the reason I'm smiling is because I majored in applied mathematics in the university, and we were trained how to do the computer graphics back in the days, and we were taught about the vector mathematics and how the raster is done. One of the assignments back in the days when we were in the university was to write a simple graphic editor where you would have the bucket of paint, and you would need to paint an area, and you would basically play with the splines in order to create those curves that are bending nicely and stuff. So I basically have like an essential understanding how the computer graphics work, and that helps me, you know, drawing digitally. So I was smiling because I think your suspicions are well grounded based on what I know from that course in computer graphics.
And
I'm sure there is something about it.
Interesting. Well, we'll have to. I'll put that on the list for later, and I'll do some digging, and maybe we can have an answer for that at some future point. I think at this point, I want to switch over to another question, and this I ask of each guest. It's the idea of three tips, three things that you can recommend for someone who, let's say they're getting into visual thinking, they're starting to use it, they see the benefits. Maybe they've hit a plateau and they just need a little encouragement, or they're just hungry for more ideas. And they would love to hear Yuri's concepts, either philosophical or practical, around tips that they can follow to keep on improving in their practice.
Well, I'll try to keep it very practical and very pragmatic, and I'll try to stay away from the philosophical angle to it, leaving it out for a later conversations with those people when they are comfortable in the field, because a lot of abstract mumbo jumbo philosophy might scare them off.
Yeah.
And that's probably for geeky nerds like us, because we are bored with simple stuff and we want to make our lives more difficult. Probably that's the reason why. But if I'm trying to keep it really practical, I think the advice number one goes like this. I think it's important to remember that it's a powerful tool that helps you do your job better. And what helps me to explain this to the people I'm trying to reveal the world of visual thinking, maybe for the first time, I compared visual thinking to playing with Lego cubes. And it's important what you model. It's not important what are the pieces and how you came up with those pieces. So as long as the model helps you solve the problem, you're doing something good. So don't focus on getting the pieces of the right color or the right shape. It's not important. So the metaphor goes like this. The Lego cubes are your drawings, your icons you're using, or the style and the elaboration of those drawings. So don't try to use the fancy ones. Just use the ugly ones, but the ones that allow you to model. Because if you get stuck with producing the Lego cubes of a certain quality, then there is not enough time to build the model. Or you might become discouraged from getting to phase two, when you have to build a model because you gave up on coming up with good cubes, right? The same with the drawings. Just, you know, get over the phase of having the cubes. Just be sure you can get some cubes of some quality, but quality enough to play with the model. Get to the phase of model. It's much, much more important than the quality of cubes. Mm-hmm. So keep it super simple.
Okay.
Once you embrace this idea that you are here for modeling, not for the quality and fanciness of cubes, then two things are important about the cubes. The writing cubes are probably the most important. Fix your writing. I usually ask people in the training also to relax the situation a bit, like raise your hands, how many people in the room are happy with their handwriting. And maybe like, I don't know, a one or two guys out of 10, 15 will raise their hands. And then I ask them the question, like, how many people can read their handwriting, but others can't? And then, you know, more hands go up. And then I ask them, like, how many people can write something down, but then cannot read it 20 minutes later? And then there is a lot of laugh, but always 3 or 4 hands go up. And it's a bit scary, because if you cannot read your own handwriting or other people cannot read your handwriting, you cannot effectively communicate. And writing is one of the most fundamental building blocks in your modeling. So if you are one of those guys who cannot read their own handwriting 20 minutes after you wrote it on the whiteboard, it's very serious and you need to work on that. And it's not that difficult to fix your handwriting. Practically speaking, you can fix it almost immediately by just slowing down when you write and using all capitals. Just that alone can really raise the bar of quality. And then there is more to it, but just being aware of this being a critical part, because a lot of people think like, okay, visual thinking is about drawing probably, so I just need to learn how to draw, right? But I tell people, no, fix your writing, because like 80% of your diagrams is labels and text.
Yeah, good point.
And then lastly, the third one would be then the drawing, if it scares you, and for a lot of people, that's the major obstacle of not getting into the world of visual thinking, and also the most favorite excuse not to use that tool. Well, I'm not an artist, you know, I cannot draw, I haven't been drawing since I was in the primary school. Oh, it's for kids, or it's for talented people, or it's for artists, or it's for graphic designers, I'm a project manager. So if that's the case, then the third advice is, okay, fine, but remember the building blocks. So you are intimidating of certain types of building blocks, which are drawings. Then find a set of super simple to draw icons and copy them a few times before you memorize how to do that. And really, we're talking about maybe 20 to 30 icons that you would use the most in your daily visualizations with other people. I'm talking about a simple icon for a person, a simple icon for a document, and so on. And usually, we're talking about very simplistic icons that everyone can draw. So learn those few icons, adjust them to your current level of drawing, and just forget about that fear. Just start modeling. Again, back to the first one, we're here because of the modeling, because of bettering our thinking skills. And if the lack of the building blocks of writing and icons stands in your way, fix it. It's not that difficult.
Those are three great tips. I think building on, you know, thinking like you're using a Lego, improving your writing, and then just building a basic set of practical icons that apply to you. It's a really great foundational way to start and move forward, for sure. That's really good. Thank you, Yuri.
My pleasure.
It's always good to hear other recommendations, and you just never know who's listening, how that might hit them perfectly in this moment, and that would be the the thing that sort of opens the door for them. So really good. And now we're going to shift into the final section, which is how can people get in touch with you? I mentioned LinkedIn and Instagram. I imagine there's probably some other places where people can find you. Tell us the places that you you visit the most. And if you visit there, what are your handles or your usernames in those places so they can find you?
Of course. And with great pleasure. You can hook up with me on LinkedIn, and you can find me by my name, Yuri Malyshenko. I would probably not spell it right now because
we can have it in the show notes.
Available. Yeah, it will be there on the show notes. So feel free to reach out. I am very open to new connections, and I would definitely get in touch with you there. And then I'm very active on Instagram, and I, as we discussed in depth with you, Mike, earlier mm-hmm. in this conversation, I experiment with new content, and I'm really attentive to feedback. And if you want to engage in a creative conversation, exchanging posts, and you know, kind of stuff, please let's get connected there as well. And you can find me on Instagram through my ID, which is vizthinker, VIZ.THINKER. Mm-hmm. I also started a podcast on visual thinking November last year. I was greatly influenced by your podcast, Mike, and I was so inspired that I decided that I wanted to give it a try. Mm-hmm. And if you like this type of content and you would want to give a go and listen to some of the conversations I'm recording there, then you can find my podcast on Apple and on Spotify. It's called Visual Thinking, and me as an author. So hopefully you can get it through that. And that should be enough to get in touch. And a good starting place. Yes.
Yeah, and I'm a fan of the podcast too. I was mentioning to Yuri before we began recording that I love the idea of him doing a podcast and reaching to his network because it's different than mine, and I get to hear from a few people who I know and have interacted with, and many people that I don't know that are very fascinating and interesting. So it just broadens your perspective to realize how much visual thinking and these skills cut across every skill, every use, which is really encouraging, right? To think it's not just this little community, which is always growing, but the fact that it's growing and it's going into other spaces is really encouraging, I think. And I think both Yuri and I were remarking on how we felt that was really encouraging for the community, that we're cutting across these typically siloed things that people, you know, don't always cross over, that I think visual thinking is a way to cross over those silos and to branch and bring them together to work together in a way that they hadn't imagined before. And, you know, having a podcast where you can hear the way other people think in other spaces, super valuable. I think it's a really great effort, and I thank you for sharing that with everyone. Yuri, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been a great pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, this has been a lot of fun. This will be a really interesting podcast for everyone to listen to, and I hope that you enjoyed this discussion that Yuri and I had. And again, follow Yuri, reach out to him. Really cool guy. And until the next episode of the Sketchnote Interview Podcast, this is Mike Rohde and Yuri Malyshenko signing off. We'll see you soon.
The Sketchnote Army Podcast was created by me, Mike Rohde, and brought to you by Rohdesign Studios. It's produced and edited by Alec Polianis of Amp Creative Studios. The theme music was created by John Schiedemeyer. Special thanks to Chris Wilson for his hard work on show notes. To support the creation of this show, I invite you to buy one of my books, the Sketchnote Handbook or the Sketchnote Workbook. You can find the books on Amazon or go to peachpit.com and use the code RODY40 for 40% off. Please share this podcast with other visual thinking friends and be sure to leave a nice rating on iTunes or your favorite podcast listening app so others can find the show.